Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and this week we look at one of the films of the year. Atonement is by one of the fastest rising directors in the world, Joe Wright, and we have an exclusive interview with Joe about directing Keira Knightley and James McAvoy, adapting an instant literary classic and capturing one of the most remarkable shots in recent British film. It's also Back to 82 time with the re-release of hip-hop classic Wild Style, and we also look forward to next week's Edinburgh International Film Festival. It's all on this week's Film Weekly. But let's start with Atonement. It's certainly one of the most beautiful and moving British films of the year, handsomely shot and smartly adapted by Christopher Hampton from Ian McEwan's novel. Keira Knightley plays Cecilia Tallis, whose nascent romance with her housekeeper's son, James McAvoy, is cut short by the tales of her younger sister, Bryony, and the advent of the Second World War. I met up with Joe Wright in his Soho office the other week to congratulate him on a film which has already been picked to open next month's Venice Film Festival and which I think will take the young British director all the way to the Oscars. Joe Wright, congratulations. Atonement is a fabulous piece of work, which I was very nervous about seeing it because it's not generally something I like, a period drama, but you sort of bring this modern sensibility to it.
I don't really see it as being a period drama because it's told from the point of view of the present day, or rather 1999. And so I see it as being a contemporary piece that looks back at a certain period in someone's life. So although a lot of it's set in the past, I've always seen it as being a contemporary piece, really.
Is that what attracted you to it? Because when I heard that you were doing this next after Pride and Prejudice, I thought, oh, you know, come on, Joe, bring us kicking and screaming into the present.
Well, one of the things that attracted me to it was the modernity of the structure and the storytelling style. It felt very modern as a film. It's about storytelling, and it's about the purpose of storytelling, and it's about the reason why happy endings are important to us and to us as artists or storytellers, and also important to the audience and readers, and what they're for, how they can help heal and how stories can destroy. And so all of those, I mean, coming out of Pride and Prejudice, which was the first thing I'd ever done with a happy ending, and I felt somehow, you know, happy endings were against my socialist principles, so I'd betrayed my family by doing a happy ending.
But isn't any ending necessarily happy? I think just I don't think you're
because it ends.
Well, just because it's the finish of something. There is necessarily closure of a book or closing credits, we call them. So, you know, psychologically we refer to it as, or shrink ways, we refer to it as closure on an episode. But any ending in some ways is that.
But a happy ending in the sense that, you know, the boy and girl go off into the sunset together or into the sunrise in the case of Pride and Prejudice, that there's definitely a kind of hope there. And a lot of the films I've always loved, Ken Loach's or Alan Clarke or kind of British realist work, has had a more kind of bleak ending and a bleak resolution, if you like.
But the Atonement has, it's safe to say, it's not ruining anyone who hasn't seen the film or the book. It has both of those things. It has kind of hope, and it has the bleak element behind it.
But it's about happy endings. It's about what they're for.
And it's about the very fact that we can create them.
Yeah, exactly. And that we can create some kind of structure in our lives through storytelling, and we can form a narrative out of the chaos of our lives.
Yeah, I always remember in Annie Hall when Woody Allen gets his first play, and he says, and there's a happy ending in the play, they kiss and they walk off into sunset, and he says, what do you want? You know, we try and do this in art because we can't get it to work out in life.
Exactly. And that certainly felt the reason for making the film coming out of Pride and Prejudice.
Did you think, oh no, I should make a kind of modern, more Loachian British, modern British realistic kind of piece?
People kept on telling me I should, and I kept on, like you, to be honest, I feel that that's quite a superficial element to storytelling. I don't really consider whether something is set in the present, past, or future, or indeed if it's set in some mythical landscape. It's to me, it's about the emotions of the characters, and that's the point of the story.
Yeah. You know? No, you were surprised that I liked it.
Yes,
which I'm rather surprised that you're surprised that I liked it, but I'm rather pleased that you could try and kind of read me enough to know that I would...
Well, whenever you say, I've just seen the best film of the year, what's that, Jason? Shane Meadows is, This Is England or whatever, and so, I know what you like.
But I did like this very much, and I think it's because perhaps, I've always kind of liked a war story in a way, because I just think that the young man taken from his comfort zone and put into a war zone, if you like, is something that hopefully we'll never have to face. Our generation will never have to face, but generations before us have always had to face it. And and I think even when something like Iraq happens, I think, well, what would I do? Would I join up? Would I actually be forced to?
The thing about the Second World War, of course, is it's the last really ethical war. I mean, it's the last war that we really... we romanticise it now because it's a war where we knew that we were right and we were fighting for a just and humanitarian cause, if you like, and that doesn't exist anymore.
No, really. But very few people have managed to take a, as you say, romantic view of the war that we have. You've got a romantic film, if you like, a kind of almost epic, sweeping, classic, leanish kind of romance going on, but your war scenes... if anything, some of the most kind of anti-romantic view of war one scene, especially of World War II from our point of view, which I thought was very brave.
I mean, it's the scenes at Dunkirk Beach are about waste, really, and about the wastage of human life, but also the wastage of everything. You know, everything in that scene is getting just destroyed and wasted, and I think that's the tragedy of war, is the wastage.
I mean, it's amazing to do it after Spielberg had probably done what many would say was the definitive D-Day landing, to take a kind of different approach to it.
But the D-Day landing we were prepared for. I mean, the D-Day landing was when we can't, Dunkirk happened and we got our acts together and went back in there and kicked their asses. But at Dunkirk, we were stupid. I mean, we were like fighting with bows and arrows, practically.
I mean, is this something that war's always... I mean, you've done kind of... You quite like staging a battle scene. You've done it. You've done this before.
I like scale. It's fun and it's gratifying to the ego.
Because you can sit there and shout at people.
No, I just like lots of people. I just like a big canvas. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I'm not sure if it's gratification for the ego is the real reason, but it's to be there on Red Car Beach with 1,000 extras and horses and boats and. Is so much fun. It's just
I can imagine.
And really,
But also a lot of pressure, I'd have thought. I mean, just let's talk, just before we kind of go on to the other aspects of the film, because it is such a remarkable piece of adaptation. What you did with the war scenes is the bit in the book that I would have thought was kind of the hardest.
Yeah,
you've kind of left the book more in those moments more than any other point. And this tracking shot, that you and your cameraman Seamus McGarvey have sort of come up with, I've got a feeling it's the longest in British film.
I don't know if it is, but it certainly felt like it.
It is all one take.
Yes, it's all one take. As opposed to Children of Men, in which it isn't all one take.
Is that not? Because that's another one that people have said.
I know.
I thought it was a lie. So tell us technically how you managed that, talking about how scary it is.
Technically, it's actually quite simple. It's basically rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing. When we had a big map... of the location, and Sarah Greenwood and I, the designer, and I plotted out where things should be, where the boat should be, and I kind of started on the map to work out a simple line. What I wanted to do was not reveal the whole thing until the very end, so that it grew. So I kind of worked out a rough route for the camera and the characters.
And it was a track, it wasn't a steady cam.
No, it's a steady cam. It's a steady cam. But it starts off on a motorised vehicle, on a golf buggy, and then the steady cam operator gets off the golf buggy, walks up to the bandstand, goes round the bandstand, and then sits back down onto a rickshaw and is pulled back and then gets off the rickshaw and ends up walking up the...
And all the time James and his crew
are walking.
And all
the time everyone's choreographed. And I'm behind the camera shouting, now, 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 now. And
cue the naked men. Cue the horses.
Yes. And it was just fun, really. I mean, it was just... It was, we got them all down there at 6 a.m, or started to get the extras down there at 6 a.m. And I'd given a big speech, which made me feel very much like Monty. I gave a big speech to them all about how we were, what we were trying to do and how we were trying to reenact the experience of young British men and how they must have been very scared. And I likened them to a kind of an away team supporters who had just lost a big match But added to that was a mortal fear that they're about to get killed.
If you've ever been up to Birmingham City, you're exactly. very similar.
And a lot of the lads were from the local football supporters teams, you know. And so then we started kind of placing them, and each group I'd give a little action to and give a little direction to, help them find characters and what they were doing and why they were there. Yeah. And that went on all day, and we'd walk the route and refine it. And so everyone felt involved. Every single extra was given a direction and a thought.
Because it is, I mean, you have kind of paint, there are great swooshes of colour and it is like a canvas. Yeah. You've kind of daubed it's like lovely. Nick Nolte, New York Stories, just kind of hurling paint.
That's a nice reference. it was fun, you know, and so we worked it through and through and through. And I, weirdly, I mean, the worst thing that could have happened if it had been windy, because the wind would have knocked the Steadicam off. But I had a feeling that we were going to be all right. And the weather... miraculously, something I always touch wood. I'm very lucky with weather, and so I had faith. I kind of had faith that we were going to have a beautiful evening, and everyone was shitting themselves. You know, the production were just crapping themselves because it was by far the most expensive day's filming that any of them had ever
and
done.
No way would you come. You couldn't come back
exactly.
Tomorrow.
So, and then at I think it was 5:30, we did the first take, and it was pretty messy. And then at like 6:30, we did the second take, and that was getting better. And then 7 o'clock, we went for the third take, and that was the one. I mean, I tried to do a fourth take, but the Steadicam operator literally collapsed halfway through.
So how long is the
It's about 5.5 minutes.
Is it? Yeah. And it feels a bit longer than that because I think it dawns on you that. My God, he's going for the one. he's going for this one shot.
There's some things that, you know, I mean, like there's three horses that are shot, but I didn't quite catch all three. You know, you only really see one being shot, and there's some stuntmen doing some things they shouldn't be doing. And
let's just talk a bit about Kira, because she's fantastic in this. Mm. And it wasn't that long ago that you were berating BAFTA members for sort of ignoring her a bit.
I
gave him a rap across the knuckles. Didn't harm the film, didn't harm anyone, really. I don't think this time they'll... And I know it sets you up well for this time, I think, because they'll probably take notice this time.
I hope they take notice, because I think she's exquisite. You know, she's an incredibly intuitive actor. It's, actors are so funny. They all have different ways, you know, of working. Romola, for instance, who I admire equally, is a very... intellectual actor, and you know, I remember in a scene in the Balham scene when they all meet, I said to Romola, "What are you thinking about at this moment?" And she went, "I'm thinking about the sexual politics of the da 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 whatever," you know, some kind of very intellectual answer, which was fascinating and brilliant, and perfect for Bryony. And then I said to Kira, "What are you thinking about?" And Kira said, "I'm thinking that she's grown breasts," which was Kira works on a very intuitive and very clever way, and we now are at a stage where I can kind of, she can give me a look and I know that she wants to go for another take, or I can give her a look and she knows that she must stop pouting or that she must, you know.
I do think you've got the best out of her twice now. I mean, you say there's.
I think all actors respond well to being loved. And being respected and being encouraged and being taken seriously. And I think that's the director's job, is to make people feel like they are wonderful and brilliant and good at their jobs. And that's really... And just talk to her and talk to her and talk to her. And that's with all of the actors. That's not just Kira. And it seems to get good results out of people. But that's just... life, isn't it?
It sounds like common sense, but the number of people that don't manage it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are scared of actors as well, because they think that acting is some kind of weird witchcraft or magic kind of thing, and they don't really understand that it is just a craft. It's like dance, or you know, it's literally something that, you know, obviously requires talent, but once one is talented, you refine it and you work with it. It's something to talk about. It's not something just to be afraid of.
It's a great journey, obviously, making a film like this. But I mean, now now we let you go, and you go off on a great journey with it, which, you know, yeah. I do think could kind of go all the way to around, you know, awards season, or you're starting in Venice,
yeah,
kicking off Venice.
That's the most amazing result. I've never dreamed of doing something like that. I mean, I being such a big fan of European cinema and proper classy cinema.
Yeah, and I think they'll like it as well. Yeah. I mean, luckily I've been in Venice the last sort of 6 or 7 years, and this will play really well. They will love it there,
good.
I think.
I hope so. Yeah. It'd be a gutting if they did.
Started booing you and throwing you into the canal.
Yeah, that would be really bad. Yeah.
Well, wish you the best of luck with it, and I wish you the best of luck with the afterlife of the film. But I really was extremely impressed. And I thought it was a gorgeous piece of work, and was very, very moved by it, as well as delighted by the kind of tricksiness.
Did it make you laugh?
It made me. It was very witty. The opening started were very witty, which I think gets forgotten because it then gets a lot darker in terms of its tone. But I did love the wittiness, and I thought Kira handled that beautifully. The repartee and the deliciousness of the words in the script. It fizzes along beautifully like that, like a British wartime drama should.
Yes.
And then it has the kind of thump, as you say, of a very modern classic.
Good. Thank you very much indeed.
Joe Wright there, whose Atonement opens in the UK on September the 7th. Remember, you heard the first interview here on Film Weekly. The 61st Edinburgh International Film Festival kicks off on the 15th of August with Jamie Bell in Hallam Foe. The artistic director of that festival joins me now, Hannah McGill. Welcome to Film Weekly, and congratulations on your first year as artistic director. And you've got a fantastic programme ahead of it, and loads of news as well. I mean, your plate is full.
Yes, it is. It's been sort of like doing two full-time jobs at once, kind of preparing the festival and preparing the news. So, yes, it's great.
Well, let's kick off with that news, because we like to be immediate here on Film Weekly. The Edinburgh International Film Festival, after 61 years in an August slot, is now going to move to June.
To June, yeah.
I mean, that's like a seismic shift in the film festival world.
Well, it is, and it is in the Edinburgh Festival's world as well, so it's a big deal. Yeah, and this is why I'm a shadow of my former self and completely exhausted, because we've been preparing something very major to spring on the world. So, yeah, but it's something that's been considered at this festival for a very long time, actually, and it was about taking the jump now and preparing. So, yeah, it's very exciting.
So what's the thinking behind it? Because, I mean, the thinking behind having it in August is fairly clear, in that Edinburgh is basically the world capital of arts during August. You've got the Fringe, you've got the International Festival, you've got, well, every festival under the sun. So perhaps maybe I'm answering my own question there at the same time, because it's very, very crowded up there.
Well, actually, it's sort of the other way around, in that we were one of the festivals that began that cultural centrality that Edinburgh now has. In 1947, the International Festival set up, and so did the Film Festival alongside, and the Fringe and the Book Festival and all the other wonderful, wonderful things grew up around that nucleus. So the frenzy of Edinburgh in August has happened around us, which is marvellous. But it does mean that in 61 years, a lot of things change. Things change in the sense that the Edinburgh August festivals have grown and grown and grown and grown. And also things change in the film industry. I mean, the other thing about being 61 years old is that an international film festival was a new idea when we started. Cannes was brand new, Venice was brand new. We were one of the first at all. So the whole distribution calendar and the relationship to film festivals was also something that grew up around us. And that's all great, but it also means that we have to adjust to the climate that we're now in.
So because you face competition, I mean, this is a very busy time for film festival directors and film critics. I mean, my case is unpacked at this time of year, because you've got Locarno, you've got Edinburgh, you've got Venice following hard upon, then Rome and then London. I mean, it's a real kind of logjam of festivals.
It is, in a sense, and what that means is, in a way, it means you're just not spreading the wealth evenly through the year, you know, and that applies to Edinburgh and, as you say, to international film festivals. And it makes things awkward for distributors choosing what they're going to do with their films. It makes it awkward, as you say, for press covering them. And it makes it awkward for us coming ahead of a logjam, as you say, of massive festivals.
So have you found it difficult this year, Hannah, luring this? Because there's simply so many kind of major festivals for which, you know, a good film will want to kind of get the maximum publicity out of it. Have you found it difficult this year? Whilst you're pondering this move, have you kind of said, you know what, you're absolutely right. It's becoming more and more of a nightmare.
Well, actually, it wasn't so much about the availability of films to us. I mean, putting the programme together this year, I was not hampered by our timing in the calendar. What we are somewhat hampered by is our relationship with the industry and what happens in August. I mean, for instance, it sounds like a small point, but for us it's major, that the entirety of France goes on holiday in August, you know? and there's all kinds of things about the focus of the international arts media on the general Edinburgh festivals that means that a programme as strong as ours, those films are not necessarily getting the spotlight of attention that they merit because there's so much competition for coverage in Edinburgh, and that's a brilliant thing. But I know from when I was a journalist covering the film festival in August that I would go to my editor and say, I've got this many stories, I've got this many reviews, and he would say, I can give you 400 words of speech. You know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, you know, the celebration that is Edinburgh in August is a wonderful thing, and we love being part of it, and incidentally, we very much hope to continue being part of it in some way. But to give our event sort of sole status in Edinburgh at that time of year asserts its credibility as a cinema event and as an industry stop-off that's important in the calendar. So, yeah, it's about clarity. It's about your voice being heard in a particular way.
So June is going to be the month. Of course, very long nights you're going to get as well in June.
Well, this is the other wonderful thing. We're going to be in midsummer in Scotland, which means it hardly gets dark at all, which is lovely.
Half a showing films, though, if it doesn't get dark.
Well, it'll be nice for people to come outside and then run down the street and, you know, go to the pub and it'll still feel like daytime. It's lovely.
So this also means that you've had to presumably ask a lot of people in Edinburgh. I mean, it's a great town. It's quite a conservative town. How was it kind of touting this new proposed extra festival around the place?
It's really interesting because we were prepared. We obviously had to prepare for all possible outcomes, and we didn't know, really. But as I said before, this is something that's been talked about for a long time. So the idea has been sort of tentatively mooted. There is nothing harder than trying to canvass opinion whilst keeping a secret. So it's been a very delicate process. But what's been rather wonderful is that the important partners and people that we work with closely in terms of the city and the country have all seen it as a very positive thing, because the analogy that I keep using is that at the moment August in Edinburgh is like a child having its birthday on Christmas Day and getting pissed off about not getting enough presents, you know? And you know that they used to do that thing sometimes when I was little with a child that had that, would get another birthday in June, halfway through the year, in order to spread out, you know, the fun through the year. And so that's the way we're seeing it, is that at the moment you've got an audience who are having to choose between an embarrassment of riches in August and establishing a new cultural event in Scotland at another time of year. It's just good news for everybody.
For more info on all the films mentioned by Hannah and all the news and tickets, go to www.edfilmfest.org.uk. And now for Film Weekly's super slick rundown of the week's releases. Rush Hour 3 is deeply rubbished and deeply racist, as Jackie Chan and the detestable Chris Tucker team up to offend women, blacks, gays, Chinese, Japanese, Jews and the French in a lumbering farrago that sees our cops travel to Paris and fall off the Eiffel Tower. Unfortunately not for real. The week after Ingmar Bergman's death signalled the end of an era for many, it's particularly upsetting to see Max von Sydow turn up here in a tired-looking cameo. The ridiculous Roman Polanski also pops up wearing a moustache and clearly not heeding his own advice about forgetting Chinatown. In The Walker, Woody Harrelson does a Truman Capote impression as a Washington escort for wealthy uptight women such as Lily Tomlin, Lauren Bacall and Kristin Scott Thomas, for whom he puts his life and reputation on the line when he claims to have uncovered the murder of her lover. Paul Schrader writes and directs with creepy skill here, but the film has a nasty strain of misogyny about it and never matches the studies in isolation, anger and guilt that suffused his early characters found in films such as Taxi Driver and American Gigolo. License to Wed is a leading contender for the worst film of the year and the worst performance of Robin Williams' career, which is really saying something. Here he's a creepy priest bent on testing the love of a young couple who want him to marry them. The dreadful Mandy Moore is in it, simpering and pouting away, and there's barely a single laugh to be had. Groans, however, rang through the auditorium for such moments as Williams' priest saying, "Let's get the flock out of here." Indeed. Waitress is a quirky little number from former indie actress Adrienne Shelley, who was unfortunately murdered in her New York apartment after the completion of this, her directing debut. She co-stars as one of three waitresses in a Deep South pie shop where the pie maker has fallen pregnant to a bullying husband and begins an affair with a new doctor. This is twee stuff, all delivered in drawly voiceover, twinkly music and kooky dialogue. There are occasional laughs, but unless you're a big Hal Hartley fan, a big girl, or as soft as a marshmallow mud pie, you'll probably not want to eat much further than the crust. Transylvania marks a return to the screen for Tony Gatliff, the Algerian-born director of such gypsy gems as Gajo Dilo and Lacho Drom. His recent films have, however, tended towards the annoying, and this latest tips over the edge into screamingly irritating. Asia Argento, all dirty fingernails and even dirtier looks, is a hopeless romantic, all heartbroken over a gypsy musician who left her in Paris. She's come now to Transylvania to find him, but takes up instead with a travelling swindler and, as she usually does, has uncomfortable-looking sex while a big black bear rummages in a nearby dustbin and toothless violinists follow her down muddy streets. With its hopeless clichés and paltry script, the intended ethnographic humanity of this film completely misfires, and I'm sure that, if anyone ever went to see it, it would do the Romani cause much more harm than good. Cast your minds back, if you will, to 1982, the birth of scratching, breakdancing, when all you needed for fun was a mat in a park and some long basketball socks up to your knees, some silky satin shorts, and the sound of Grandmaster Flash scratching on the turntables. That is the world of Wild Style, a world to which we return to mark 25 years of this seminal hip-hop movie. It's being re-released in the UK at the ICA ahead of a release on DVD, and we are delighted here on Film Weekly to attract down the director, the man who threw himself into the graffiti world of the Bronx. Charlie Ahern joins me on the line from New York now. Charlie, welcome to the 21st century, but I was really enjoying being stuck back in the latter end of the 20th century with your film. The memories it brought back, those trains hurtling through the Bronx, that fantastic music. It must have been a quite amazing time to be shooting a film.
There was a sense of a kind of internal combustion, like there was a sense that it's hard to tell which was the first spark, but there was a kind of explosion of creativity around that time, and there was a kind of synergy of purpose of different people creating things around the city, whether they were people out in the subway yards or in the clubs. And part of it had to do with kind of breaking down a kind of apartheid of culture that existed, in the sense that New York City in the late 70s was a place of extreme economic crises. The poverty was painful for whole swaths of the population.
Absolutely. I mean, we remember just the movies from that time. I mean, there was rubbish in the streets, stuff piled up. It was decay and strife.
And there was a sense that the government itself, government services were breaking down. You'd find when you go to the subway that the subway station was closed because of lack of funds. And in places like Bronx and Brooklyn, the people in the various scenes were almost like in a bubble.
Right.
And what was going on in the summer of 1980 when I got involved with Wild Style was there were a number of individuals like Fab Five Freddy, myself, and many other people were picking their heads up and looking around and saying, hey, let's go over here, or look at this over here, and recognizing the connectedness of everything that was going on. And it was a very sexy, explosive thing for people of different races to be mixing and different economic backgrounds. And there was a kind of openness at that moment from many people in different directions. You had like Afrika Bambaataa was coming down from the Bronx to play in a club like the Mud Club, or people going from the downtown scene up to the Bronx to create art things.
Right. And I just wanted to ask you about the history of hip-hop films after yours. I mean, there was all those breakdance movies, there was the Kid and Play stuff. Has anything kind of, for you, captured that essence again, or is it all kind of, has it all, you know, has anything really kind of been faithful to the culture still? Who do you admire
in that? Well, there are dozens of films that have been made that have taken a piece of it and focused on a piece of it. And, you know, hip-hop is sort of like the exploding universe, you know. Every given moment, it seems to be falling away from itself and expanding at the same time. Mm-hmm. And the bodies of it seem to be drifting apart while it's expanding. And in this sense that there is a whole world of, let's say, different kinds of DJing with different kinds of DJ competitions. Or if you go into the MCing, there's whole worlds upon worlds of different kinds of MCs, and there mm-hmm. are different, you know, commercialities or non-commercialities or political bents, and it's a very complicated landscape, right?
Charlie Ahern there, director of Wild Style, re-released at the ICA and soon to be found on DVD. You have been rocking with the best, and that brings us to an end of Film Weekly for another edition. I've been J to the A to the S to the O to the N, and the show has been produced by the master, M-A-S-T-E-R, Paul Noble. And as you heard, we'll be in Edinburgh next week, so I'll talk to you from there. Until then, see you, and happy viewing.